Turn to the Old Testament for our scripture reading. We're turning again to the first book of Samuel, chapter 26, and we read the chapter together. The Ziphites went to Saul at Gibeah and said, "Is not David hiding on the hill of Hakilah, which faces Jeshimon?" So Saul went down to the desert of Ziph with his 3,000 chosen men of Israel to search there for David. Saul made his camp beside the road on the hill of Hakilah, facing Jeshimon. But David stayed in the desert. When he saw that Saul had followed him there, he sent out scouts and learned that Saul had definitely arrived. Then David set out and went to the place where Saul had camped. He saw where Saul and Abner, son of Ner, the commander of the army, had lain down. Saul was lying inside the camp with the army encamped around him. David then asked Ahimelech the Hittite and Abishai, son of Zeruiah, Joab's brother, "Who will go down into the camp with me to Saul?" "I'll go with you," said Abishai. So David and Abishai went to the army by night, and there was Saul, lying asleep inside the camp with his spear stuck on the ground near his head. Abner and the soldiers were lying round him. Abishai said to David, "Today God has given your enemy into your hands. Now let me pin him to the ground with one thrust of my spear. I won't strike him twice." But David said to Abishai, "Don't destroy him. Who can lay a hand on the Lord's anointed and be guiltless?" "As surely as the Lord lives," he said, "the Lord himself will strike him. Either his time will come and he will die, or he'll go into battle and perish. But the Lord forbid that I should lay a hand on the Lord's anointed. Now get the spear and water jug that are near his head and let's go." So David took the spear and water jug near Saul's head, and they left. No one saw or knew about it, nor did anyone wake up. They were all sleeping because the Lord had put them into a deep sleep. Then David crossed over to the other side and stood on top of the hill some distance away. There was a wide space between them. He called out to the army and to Abner, son of Ner, "Aren't you going to answer me, Abner?" Abner replied, "Who are you? Who calls to the king?" David said, "You're a man, aren't you? And who is like you in Israel? Why didn't you guard your lord the king? Someone came to destroy your lord the king. What you have done is not good. As surely as the Lord lives, you and your men deserve to die because you did not guard your master, the Lord's anointed. Look around you. Where are the king's spear and water jug that were near his head?" Saul recognized David's voice and said, "Is that your voice, David, my son?" David replied, "Yes, it is, my lord the king." And he added, "Why is my lord pursuing his servant? What have I done and what wrong am I guilty of? Now let my lord the king listen to his servant's words. If the Lord has incited you against me, then may he accept an offering. If, however, men have done it, may they be cursed before the Lord. They've now driven me from my share in the Lord's inheritance and have said, 'Go serve other gods.' Now do not let my blood fall to the ground far from the presence of the Lord. The king of Israel has come out to look for a flea, as one hunts a partridge in the mountains." Then Saul said, "I have sinned. Come back, David, my son. Because you considered my life precious today, I will not try to harm you again. Surely I have acted like a fool and have erred greatly." "Here's the king's spear," David answered. "Let one of your young men come and get it. The Lord rewards every man for his righteousness and faithfulness. The Lord gave you into my hands today, but I would not lay a hand on the Lord's anointed. As surely as I valued your life today, so may the Lord value my life and deliver me from all trouble." Then Saul said to David, "May you be blessed, my son David. You will do great things and surely triumph." David went on his way, and Saul returned home. I wonder if you've ever had the experience of talking to someone, conversation, and after that you never saw them again. You didn't realize as you talked to them that that was the last time you talked to them. Maybe sudden death intervened. Many of us have had that experience. Some other circumstances, division, separation. And you think, I never realized that that was the last time I'd speak to him or speak to her. That can come as quite a shock, a sobering thought. And maybe we wonder how much difference would it have made to what you said or how you spoke to them if you'd realized that that was going to be the last time you spoke to them. Would you have spoken differently? Was there some subject that you'd always meant to speak about, and if you'd known, you'd have raised it, you'd have talked about it then? Maybe to talk about your faith to somebody that you don't believe is a Christian. You didn't realize there never would be another opportunity. What difference might it have made if you'd really realized that that was the last time you would speak to them? As we turn to 1 Samuel 26, David and Saul meet and speak for the last time. Neither of them, no doubt, realized that that was the case, but they would never speak again. As far as we can tell, they never met again. Now we come to 1 Samuel 26. I want to look at the whole chapter. We're thinking of the final encounter. The final encounter. Several things that stand out in this chapter, all of them important. The first is betrayal. Betrayal. The account we have here in chapter 26 of David sparing Saul certainly bears significant similarities to chapter 24, David sparing Saul in the cave. Now, that leads some liberal Bible scholars to say, they're actually the same event. And just the accounts have got garbled and they've turned out a bit different, but it's really the same event that's described in two different chapters. And to use the scholarly term, nonsense. You look carefully at them and you see there are fundamental significant differences between the two. They are two separate events. The opening verses, particularly here in 26, underline David's circumstances. It's just nagging, constant warfare that he's facing. Saul looking for him at every opportunity. And David is going to have to reach the throne, as we've seen again and again, through significant hardships. God's path for him is not an easy path, but it is God's path. In particular, we always need to see in the Old Testament history books that underlying the physical conflict, the swords and the spears and so forth, at a much more important level, there is a spiritual conflict. That's what's driving events, attempts to destroy the Lord's anointed. And that's what's happening in these chapters as Saul hunts David. The enemy wants to be rid of David. And the opposition to David, the Lord's anointed, really shows that in the hearts of Saul and the others, there is opposition to God himself. That's the root of it. Primarily, they wouldn't necessarily understand it this way. But fundamentally, it is an attack on God. And then on God's representative, God's anointed, David. They're revealing their hearts in their attitudes to David. And really, in this chapter, we see two betrayals. One obvious, one at first maybe not quite so obvious. The first betrayal is on the part of the Ziphites. Blatant betrayal. Is not David, they tell Saul, hiding on the hill of Hakila? We can put our finger on, we know where he is. You come and get him. And it's not the first time they've done that, you see. They have form. They have a record of this. You go back earlier to chapter 24. And there, verses 19 and 20, the Ziphites come to Saul on a previous occasion. We know where David is. We can point him out to you. And they say there, we will be responsible for handing him over. It's not just they'll tell you where he is. They'll go and do the deed. They'll bring him in and hand him over to Saul. That's the mindset of the Ziphites. Implacable enmity towards David, towards God's anointed, the future king. And a very strong commitment to the cause of Saul. They, perhaps more than many others, are dedicated supporters of Saul and his household. They want to destroy God's anointed. That, as we've said, is what is going on here. David is set apart by God to be the next king, and the Ziphites want to be the agents of destroying him. What a contrast that we have with, say, Abigail in the previous chapter. We might say, oh, well, it'd be hard for the Ziphites to realize who David is and to treat him properly. But that's not the case. Abigail had profound understanding of who David was and what role he was fulfilling in God's plan. So it's not too hard for the Ziphites. It's their spiritual condition that's revealed here. They're enemies of God's anointed because they're enemies of God. And the hand behind the Ziphites' betrayal surely is the hand of Satan himself. Because that's the spiritual war that's going on. And what he's trying to do is to snuff out the line of promise. The line that will lead through David to Messiah Jesus. And we're back, of course, to our perennial question week after week. Where is this leading? And it's leading to the Messiah, to Jesus. And that is the last place that Satan wants it to lead. Destroy David and God's promise collapses. That's the spiritual issue at the root of what's happening here. So there's a betrayal of the Ziphites, egged on by Satan. They don't realize it. They don't think in those categories, but that doesn't matter. That doesn't change the fact that this is the devil's work they're doing. Betrayal by the Ziphites, but yes, secondly, there's betrayal by Saul. Because that is how Saul is behaving in this chapter. Continued hostility to David. You can turn back to Saul's fine words in chapter 24 and how he gushed about David and how the Lord would make David king. And it sounded so good. You listen to Saul, you think, boy, there's a godly man. He's realized he's wrong. He understands David's God's man and he's changed. And as we saw when we looked at chapter 24, David didn't believe it. And he was right not to believe it. Fine words. And we encounter people with all their fine words. Ministers could paper the walls with promises and fine words that meant nothing. And Saul's words meant nothing. They sounded great. He maybe believed them himself when he said them. But they amounted to nothing. Because here he is, in pursuit of David again to kill him. Fine words amounted to nothing. And it is betrayal. You are more righteous than I. Yes, but did Saul really believe it? I know that you will surely be king. And why is Saul trying to drive a spear through David if he believes David will be king under God? It amounted to nothing. The basic reason is simply Saul is a hardened man set against God. There are debates sometimes, you know, among Bible scholars. Well, was Saul really a saved man, to use that New Testament category? Was he regenerate? And it is very hard, in the light of what we've seen and what we're going to see at the end of 1 Samuel, to think in any sense he was. Fine words. Words that sounded like words of faith. But when you watched what he actually did, you've got to say it amounted to nothing. Two betrayals. Two groups, Ziphites and Saul, set against God, and in Saul's case, sinning against the light, isn't he? Because he saw the light, you will be king. And what did he do? He got a spear, he got his troops, and he tried to kill David. Sinning against the light, oh yes, Saul certainly was. Betrayal. Secondly, we see restraint. Restraint. Now, we've seen this before, but I think each time we see it, it's stronger on the part of David. David has taken to heart the lessons of that encounter with Nabal, when impetuously he reached for his sword and he got the troops armed and they were going down to slaughter everybody in Nabal's household. And he's learned valuable lessons from particularly what Abigail had to say to him. And of course the Lord applying those words to his heart. And he's confirmed on the path he knows he has to follow. Hard path, but a path that will ultimately lead him to the place God is preparing for him, the throne. And he will receive it according to God's promise, but he'll receive it in God's way. Not in his own impetuous way, not by means of shortcuts. We saw him in chapter 24 resisting the ungodly shortcut of killing Saul. So here, who will go down into the camp with me to Saul? Looks as if he's going on a reconnaissance to gauge the strength of Saul's army, to gather intelligence, whatever. Accompanied by his nephew Abishai. Abishai was son of Zeruiah. Zeruiah was David's older sister. And Joab and Abishai and Asahel, the three brothers, were nephews of David. Hard men. Joab especially was a hard case. Abishai, not much softer. Tough men. Nephews of David. Abishai goes down with him. Down in the camp. God's put a sleep on the camp. They can go in, they can talk, they can take the spear and so on, and they're not perceived at all. And much has happened in the cave back in chapter 24. David is presented with what looks like another wonderful opportunity to take a shortcut to the throne. He didn't do it before, maybe he will this time. And that's what Abishai seems to think. Look, Saul is lying there. He is defenseless. He sends with Abishai how his mind's working. He seems to be thinking, look, okay, you wouldn't strike Saul in the cave. Fair enough. You don't want blood in your hands. But look, I'll do it. Okay, I don't care. One spear thrust, end of Saul, that's it. And your hands are clean. I'll do it. Don't bother me in the least. And that's the temptation David's presented with. He doesn't even have to strike Saul. Doesn't have to get blood in his hands. Abishai will do it for him. And of course, again, bring God's name into it. How often people do that, don't they, in temptations? Bring God's name into it. Today, God has given your enemy into your hands. How could you argue with that? It's God's doing. Come on, David. Take your opportunity. Get it over with. I'll do it for you. And it may well have been a strong temptation. See, look, there's the man that's trying to kill you. One blow struck by your nephew, he's gone. And the way to the throne will be open. And there is the apparent opportunity that David is being presented with. But he's steadfast. He is steadfast. He's not going to be moved or shaken or persuaded. He is not going to reach the throne by a path of disobedience. And he understands that. He understood it in chapter 24 in the cave. He'd had to learn it afresh in relation to Nabal. And now he's rock solid. He is not going to reach the throne by disobeying God and God's command and God's will. Do you notice, as you read through the chapter, the repeated references to the Lord's anointed? You get verse 9, for example. And he refers to Saul as my Lord the King. And there is no suggestion that David is being sarcastic or mocking and using that language. That is how he views Saul. Despite Saul's sin and his failures and everything disreputable about Saul, David still recognizes he is, at this point, the Lord's anointed king. And David will not strike him. It will not be safe spiritually. It would not be wise for him to strike Saul. Opportunity is not a good guide. Sometimes it can guide us down the wrong path. Even though the Lord's put the enemy into a deep sleep, he has left them vulnerable to a single blow from Abishai. David knows this is not God's way. This would be disobedience. However good the end, apparently, the means would be utterly ungodly. And so an apparent opportunity cannot nullify God's revealed will. And that's what David holds on to. He holds on to what he knows of the truth of God. And the truth of God is he must not strike God's anointed. And whatever opportunities present, whatever apparent advantages to him, are irrelevant. Truth is truth. Principle is principle. And he is not going to be moved from that. Again, it's well summed up by a man I've quoted before, Gordon Kenny. And Gordon says, quote, "If opportunity is automatically a mandate to act, then what need have we of principles? If you can be guided just by circumstances, if that's enough, you don't really need a Bible then, do you?" But of course you do. Because apparent opportunities and circumstances can lead you astray. And we've got to hold on to the truth of God. What we always have to do is what David does. Hold on to the biblical principles. Hold on to the truth of God. And trust God to work out his plan in his way, in his time. The Lord will keep his promises. We don't need to worry. We don't need to help him along. We've said before, look what happened to Abraham when he tried to help along God's promise of a son. And that old mess with Hagar. We hold on to biblical principle. And David's convictions, I believe, are stronger after the Nabal episode. That has really strengthened his convictions. We sang from Psalm 37, verse 5. Commit your way to the Lord. And essentially that is what David is doing here. He's committing his way to the Lord. The Lord will work it out. He doesn't know exactly how, but he will. The one thing he is sure of, he is not going to compromise biblical principles. That's the kind of people we need to be on our way through life. We need to be those who are rooted in the truth of God. People who won't be shaken from biblical principles, whatever the apparent advantage to us or to anybody else. What does God say? Then it really doesn't matter what anyone or anything else says. Circumstances, opportunities, anything else, forget it. What does God say? Restraint. Betrayal, restraint. Thirdly, estrangement. Estrangement. And this brings us to David and Saul for the last time together. David goes out of the camp, goes across the hill, and calls back to Saul, to the army, to Abner particularly. really Abner, you might say, Saul's chief of staff. And what David does really is rattle Abner's cage. You didn't do a great job, did you, Abner? You're the great fella, you're the great soldier in Israel. Hey, look what I've got. Spear, water jug beside Saul's head. What were you doing? Hey, you're not much good. And he's having a go at Abner, of course. And in days to come, of course, Abishai and his brother Joab will have a lot more to do with Abner. But it's not Abner that's the main concern, of course. It's Saul. Significant in verse 13, there was a wide space between them. Now, that's a statement of geography, if you like. There's a wide space between them. One stands here, one stands there. But there's a wide space in another sense. It's not just a physical space. Metaphorically, spiritually, there's a very wide space between David and Saul. And that becomes evident in the exchange between them, particularly in what David has to say. And what you see in that exchange is a profound estrangement between David and Saul. You really see the issue highlighted now at this late point. Words of David regarding his situation really demonstrate a sense of the injustice that he's suffering. David's opening his heart and he's really saying, this is not just the way you are treating me, Saul. What have I done? What wrong am I guilty of? And of course he knows there is nothing. It is basically groundless, this hatred, this hostility of Saul. Interesting how David puts it. He says, well, look, if the Lord has stirred you up, if it's God's hand that has you after me because of some sin I've committed, well, then the Lord may accept an offering, a sacrifice. There's a proper way to deal with that. Offer sacrifice. I'll do that for my sin. It's not for Saul to get the spear and go out and sort out David's sin. Of course, Saul knows it's not the Lord who stirred Saul up. It's man. And David spells out the alternative. If men have done it, well, what? They deserve God's curse. And David is committing himself to the Lord very clearly. May they be cursed before the Lord. And there's that awareness in David. This is all before the Lord. It's not simply David and Saul. The Lord is in this. The Lord is over this. And they're all answerable to the Lord. David knows that. And he knows his conscience is clear. He has no difficulty appealing to God for justice, to punish his enemies. No problem, because he knows he's innocent. The Lord is over all, and David understands that. I need to hear the pain, too, of what he's going through. This is not easy for David. It is a tremendous burden. In effect, he's saying, you're driving me out of the inheritance, my land here in Israel. You're leaving me no place. You're pushing me out. Do you want me to die in a foreign land? That's really what he says. My blood be shed in a far-off country. Is that what you want? Do you want me to die in a foreign country? Far from the presence of the Lord? Now, he's not saying, if I die abroad, God won't be there. David knows God's everywhere. Read the Psalms. But he'll not be in the place where the Lord is honored and worshipped. And David feels that burden. Again, to end up somewhere foreign, somewhere pagan. And yet he feels, that's where I'm being pushed by the way Saul is carrying on. And Saul, well, there he is again, all the fine words. And he can come up with them. And again, he maybe believes that he's genuine when he says it, about how great a man David is and what God's going to do through him. May you be blessed, my son David. Come on, Saul. You'll do great things and surely triumph. That sounds so good. Sounds so good. Come down. Come back, David, he says. Does David come back? Of course he doesn't. David says, here's the spear. Send one of the young men up. He can take it. There's no way David's going back. He knows how empty Saul's words are. He understands the issue. And the king's spear, isn't that so symbolic? What does the king's spear speak of? Well, it speaks on the one hand of David's faithfulness, because he had the king's spear in his hand and he didn't run it through Saul. The king's spear reminds us that at heart David's a godly man. The king's spear also reminds us of Saul's treachery. Spears were expensive. Very few people had them in those days, certainly in Israel. Saul wouldn't have a selection of spears. Very, very possible that the spear David had in his hand was the spear Saul had thrown at him twice in an attempt to kill him. David looks at it. And he knows what that spear's been used for. He knows if Saul had had his way, that spear would have run him through. Very eloquent. One spear, two completely different men. And you can see here are two men traveling in opposite directions, diverging paths. They're getting further and further away from each other. Because one is traveling on the path of obedience to God, and one is traveling on the path of disobedience that's leading him lower and lower and lower. The paths are getting further and further apart. And literally they never see each other again. And I think we can make a good case they never will see each other again. Not in time, not in eternity. Estrangement, wider and wider, will only end one way. Betrayal, restraint, estrangement, and hope. We finish with hope. Because there is hope at the end of the chapter. David puts his trust in the Lord. We already mentioned that, but we need to underline it. And he makes it clear, may the Lord value my life and deliver me. See, David says, well, I valued your life and spared you. And you might expect him to say, well, then you value my life and spare me. But he doesn't. He's no illusions that Saul would do anything of the kind. But may the Lord value my life, deliver me from all trouble. It is the voice of faith. The Lord, he says, rewards every man for his righteousness and faithfulness. It's a reward of grace, of course. He's not saying, if I'm a terribly good boy, God will pat me on the head and reward me. That's not biblical. But God in grace rewards those who are faithful and who are righteous with his enabling. Very significant, the psalm that David wrote at this period in his life is Psalm 54. We'll be singing a portion of it at the end of the service. And the title of the psalm indicates it was when the Ziphites had gone to Saul and said, is not David hiding among us? That couldn't be clearer. There's a psalm he penned in these days. And as we read through the psalm, you see that David is a man who entrusts himself wholly to the Lord. It says in verse 4, surely God is my help. The Lord is the one who sustains me. That's how he was thinking in those days. Resting in the Lord, sustained by the Lord. Saul could not begin to speak that language. It was as far from Saul's mind and Saul's soul as it could have been. The voice of God-given faith. And so David is able to face the future with faith and confidence. And again, where is it going? It is leading us ultimately to the Messiah, to Jesus. Why do I say that? Because we see something of the Messiah's spirit in Psalm 54. Because we believe it finds its fulfillment ultimately in Jesus. And the Messiah speaks, and the Messiah is the one who sees the Father as his help, who's sustained by his heavenly Father. If we turn over to Hebrews 5 and verse 7, we're told he offered up prayers and petitions with loud cries and tears to the one who could save him from death, and he was heard because of his reverent submission. It's Jesus in Gethsemane particularly. Is in view there in Hebrews 5, 7. Heard because of his reverent submission. You have it in Psalm 54. You have it in 1 Samuel 26. David foreshadows, yes, palely and imperfectly, but really, nevertheless, his descendant Messiah, Jesus. And it's because of him, because of that anointed, that king, that you and I can face the future with hope, in faith and confidence in a God who sustains us and who'll never fail us. Hope. Hope even in a dark time. Hope that shines most clearly, of course, in a dark time. And by grace, David had that hope. By grace, we can have that same hope, as ultimately it's in the Messiah, the King of Kings, our Saviour. May we have that hope to face whatever the Lord and his providence brings to each of us in faith and confidence.